Let me start with James or Jim Greeno. He earned his bachelor's degree and a master's degree in psychology from the University of Minnesota, and also a PhD in psychology from that same university. In his academic career, he started at Indiana University, actually. Not sure if everyone in Indiana knows that already, in Bloomington. University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, after that as associate professor. Then the University of California at Berkeley as professor of education and chair there. Then at the Institute of Research on Learning, in the late in the 90s, basically, of the last century. Then Stanford University and the University of Pittsburgh, where he is currently an adjunct professor of education. And more content-wise, he will speak to that a bit later on himself. Tim Noakes-Malach, he received his bachelor's degree also in psychology from the University of Wisconsin in Whitewater, a master's in cognitive psychology from the University of Illinois in Chicago, and his PhD in cognitive psychology also from the University of Illinois at Chicago, with a minor in philosophy of science. He's currently at the Beckman, and also he did his postdoctoral fellowship at the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He worked as a research scientist and an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh, where he still is as an associate professor. And now, Tim and Jim, we are very much looking forward to your introduction and then also to your talk, of course, and to the activities that you planned for us.
Okay. Thanks for the nice introduction, and hello everybody. So I think Jim will start off saying a few autobiographical bits. And hopefully our sound is good.
Let me interrupt one final time. So I forgot to mention two things. To give a quick feedback to the speakers, there is under the vote tab, you have smileys and you can just use them. And also you can type in something into the chat, of course. But the sound was very good, Tim and Jim. And let me mention one thing that I forgot as well. The whole thing, the whole webinar will be recorded. And if you don't want to be on the webinar, on the recording, then you shouldn't speak. This is, of course, not applying to the speakers of today, but all the others. So if you don't want to be on the video afterwards, then you should just not raise your hand and speak. Everyone else is, of course, invited to interact via chat, via the vote tab here with the smileys, and also, of course, via video. So sorry for interrupting. I stop here.
Frank, do you want to say something about the slides? So we stop.
Well, basically, the slides, everyone can download the slides. The link is again here from this Dropbox. You can download a PDF or a PowerPoint file. The slides are, fortunately, they are numbered, so they have numbers, and our speakers will hopefully remember to refer to the slide numbers from time to time. This is the way that worked best in the past, because some of us are participating sometimes from mobile devices and so on. So everyone downloads these slides, opens it locally, opens them, and then Tim and Jim talk us through some of these slides and refer to them. This is how it should work.
Okay. So I am looking at the first, slide number two. And as it says there, I've worked pretty, I think, consistently on the same problem for 50 some years. And that's the problem of understanding and learning concepts or learning conceptually. And in math education, as many of you are familiar, there's quite frequently people refer to a distinction between knowing procedurally and understanding conceptually. That's what I've worked on for the distance that I've gone on this journey, Frank. So the field that includes this problem was once called experimental psychology. That's what I was when I graduated from graduate school. So I entered the field as an experimental psychology. Early on, when I was beginning my research career, the name of what I did changed to cognitive psychology, although I was also a part of a group called mathematical psychologists. And in another decade, I was a cognitive scientist. And I take it now that the study of concepts and conceptual understanding has acquired the name of learning science. So I'm glad to be a learning scientist now. Continue my work. Someone needs to.
I think they directed them to the, okay, the Dropbox to, okay, get the slides.
Good. Okay.
So thanks, Frank, for the nice introduction. I'll just add a little bit to that my work is focused on learning and problem solving of people with an aim to understand, predict, and promote knowledge transfer, specifically how people acquire knowledge and skills from one situation and adapt and apply and use them in another. And my work began at, as Frank said, the University of Illinois at Chicago, and I'm happy to see people tuning in from UIC, right, as the learning sciences there were just getting started as I was finishing up and getting ready to go on to the Beckman Institute. But at UIC, I was working with Stellan Olsen in trying to understand the cognitive mechanisms of transfer and sort of the trade-off between different mechanisms like analogy and knowledge compilation, try to understand the sort of profile of what kinds of knowledge and what kinds of contexts does that knowledge get applied and what processes are triggered depending on those parameters. And then I went a few hours south to Champaign-Urbana and worked with Brian Ross in psychology, Jose Mestra in physics and educational psych, and Dan Morrow in human factors, and started to think about learning and transfer in math and science domains. So dealing with content of academic domains to think about some of the processes that I had looked at in more puzzle-like tasks during graduate school, and wrestling with some of those problems and starting to think about alternative paradigms to think about transfer, like Schwartz and colleagues' preparation for future learning. And then my journey from there took me to Pittsburgh and still focused on transfer and trying to understand transfer as happens in classrooms in educational contexts. As I was being interested in this content domain, started to take me to other, looking at other factors like motivation, variables, achievement goals, collaborative processes, and has led me to a path of trying to think hard about situative perspectives and what they contribute to this issue of knowledge transfer.
Okay, so on to slide four. This is a chance for me to remark about a little bit of terminology. For quite a few people in the field, situated cognition or situated learning refers to some learning, but not all learning. We prefer that it's that we assume that cognition and learning are always inherently situated. So instead of asking whether or not or to what degree is some piece of cognition or learning situated, we say it always is. And the question isn't how much or whether, but rather in what way or what is it situated in. And so for the title of this discussion, we actually would prefer the term situative, as in a situative framework, situative theory, situative perspective. Situative refers to us. What approach are we taking in an analysis? We just think that's less likely to invite the misconception that some cognition or learning or action is situated and some isn't. So I guess I've still got
the floor.
Still my turn. On the next slide, number five, I've mentioned three little bits of history. One was a talk that Gene Lathe gave in, and I'm a little uncertain, but only within a month. It was either the end of 84 or the beginning of 85. She reported findings in her ethnographic studies of grocery shopping and the findings of some others in who had done ethnographic work studying Brazilian street merchants. And the finding or the conclusion that seemed compelling to me was that what constituted a solution wasn't preordained, it wasn't designed into the problem, it emerged. And it was co-constructed by people who were doing the shopping or the selling, and the circumstances, what Gene called the arena in which the activity was taking place, and the cognitive analysis of problem solving at the time assumed that there was a stable problem space, and problem solving was a matter of searching in that space for a solution path. That theory won't work if we have to assume that the problem space emerges in a co-constructive way. Second little item at the same time, Lucy Suchman's book, which she titled Plans and Situated Action, that challenged assumptions of AI planning. She did the research for that at Xerox PARC, where they were very actively developing the field of artificial intelligence. So Lucy was doing ethnographic work about how people interacted with copying machines, and concluded that the help systems that they were trying to design in those systems, being computational rather than human action, had intrinsic limitations because the machine didn't know how to become a co-constructor of meaning with the properties that people have when they interact with each other. And the third one was more institutional. We founded an institute for research on learning. And the comment I want to make about that here is that when we decided to have IRL, We expected our activity to focus on developing software for a kind of learning we thought of as needing the label cognitive apprenticeship. But when people reviewed the studies of apprenticeship, they concluded that apprenticeship per se was not the important aspect of learning environments that we had expected it to be. And Jean Lave and Etienne Wenger developed the notion of legitimate peripheral participation rather than apprenticeship as referring to the important critical aspect of that. So that's a little of the beginning of what I think of, or what happened, what I was in contact with as in what we might think of as the early days of the situative program. Mm-hmm. And now,
so I think we have the overview slide.
Well, that's you.
Yeah, so just to give you a sense of our plan for the rest of today, we have this broken out into four parts with three activities. And the first two parts go together. It's basically to articulate a bit more. We've talked some about the motivation, for thinking of from a situative perspective, and then to take a look at some of the assumptions and importantly definitions and concepts that are core to the, as we see it, the situative approach, and talk about a framework for that and some ideas in that space. And we'll have a discussion sort of applying those concepts hopefully to your work and ideas. And then in part three, we'll talk about a few different types of explanation patterns for thinking about the interplay between the situative approach and sort of different levels of analysis. Mm-hmm. And then a discussion activity based on that. And then we'd like to conclude with basically thinking about very briefly some future directions for the situative project and approach. So we'll dive in to part one. Talking a bit more about some motivation and some assumptions.
Yeah, and just very, very quickly, slide seven tells you about Jim's interest. I'll just add to that it seems important to me for us to work toward a theory that's general enough to explain learning and cognition outside of classrooms and certainly outside of laboratories. that gives a coherent account of what learning and cognition depend on and how we get it to happen across the board. So I'm very pleased to hear that several of you are looking at learning in informal as well as formal classroom situations.
Yeah, that's great. And I think for my personal interest in a situative perspective and learning more about it, stem from trying to understand, as I mentioned before, transfer and particularly in classroom environments, so the more formal environments that in the classroom, as you all, many of you well know, it goes much beyond a single student and a single student's cognition, but relies much of what happens in the classroom is at the level of interactions between students and teachers or among students. And so that was one motivation for me as I started to look at and think about transfer as it happens within students in classroom contexts. Another sort of direction for me was thinking about interactions with stuff in the world. So thinking about students interacting with computer tutors, intelligent tutoring systems and what the knowledge that is being co-constructed and supported in those environments that go beyond just single individual cognition. In another way, interacting with stuff in the world, like kids experimenting in class, science experiments, building stuff, and how that stuff also supports constructing knowledge and information that's shared across individuals. And then finally, for me, most recently is, and part of this is also informed by thinking about transfer and learning in classroom context, is motivation. So how does motivation emerge in a class amongst multiple agents? It goes beyond individuals. So some constructs like achievement goals, for example, part of the, some of the concepts in that space are in fact defined upon multiple units or agents in the system. So students who have performance approach goals are in fact defining those goals in the context or in relationship to other students in the class. That is, they want to perform better than other students. And so for that goal to sort of come into effect in the individual's mind, it actually requires the support and the existence of the other students in the classroom, the classroom context. That's just one example, but there are many others. And so these are sort of come together to sort of push me to try to think a bit more about this situative approach. And we view this perspective as core to the learning sciences and as one thing that helps to separate this view from classical experimental psychology. So to start off, we're now on slide 8. I'm going to begin with just a very brief high-level summary of an example of a situative approach, some work by Randy Engel and colleagues. And this example is also discussed briefly in the core reading that we had of Greeno and Engstrom. So it draws from two central papers from Randy Engel, one Engel and Conant, 2002, published in Cognition and Instruction, and one from Engel, 2006, in the Journal of the Learning Sciences. I think those are the right journals for both of those. And part of the reason I'm starting with this sort of high-level brief example is when I get to some of the core concepts of the situative perspective, I'd like to refer back to this example to provide some concrete illustration of these concepts just very briefly as we go through them. Otherwise, for me at least, it gets fairly abstract fairly quickly. So this is an attempt to try to anchor this in an illustration. So I'll refer back to this example as we go through some of the concepts in a few slides. So across these two papers, it sort of draws from a rather large study on the interaction with of fifth grade students and their teachers in a classroom, amongst classroom activities developed in the Fostering Communities of Learners project, the FCL project by Brown and Campione. As the students worked in groups on these projects, writing reports about some endangered species, whether they were eagles, although they focused primarily on one particular group, kids thinking about and talking about whales. The activities that the students were engaged in spanned several weeks of the class, included things like creation of research groups, and the research groups had sort of within each research group they focused on a topic, eagles, whales, other individuals within that sort of had subtopics or breakout topics that they were looking at, sort of various features that support that species or could be saw as possible problems for that species that they were doing research on. They also engaged in breakout groups across groups on their various subtopics. They engage in writing individual chapters, as well as writing a joint conclusion amongst themselves, the kids, and many times we're also engaged in discussion with the teacher. So they were involved in a variety of activities, and Randy Engel and colleagues then used this set of interactions, a subset of his interactions, for two very in-depth analyses, taking a situative perspective to this data. One analysis focused on the occurrence of an extended debate in how the students classified orcas, or killer whales, sort of sparked by an experience at Marine World, where the claim was that they were in fact dolphins. Mm-hmm. This then later sort of blew up in an argument in a hallway. I think a hallway activity the students were engaged in the whale group that later became defined as the big old argument, where the students were engaged in a disciplinary practice of trying to decide whether how should they think about and how should they classify whales. Are they, or orcas, are they whales or are they dolphins? And this led to an extended debate that Randy and her colleagues looked at, Randy and Conan looked at in quite some detail. And I'll talk about a few of their conclusions in a moment. The other analysis that came a little bit later was Engel 2006, that focused on what this group of students learned and transferred about their causal explanations for why various animal species are endangered or could be threatened in particular types of environments. So they looked at the kind of reasoning that was both constructed in interactions, but also was displayed in reasoning about new situations and animals in new contexts. And so that was Engel 2006. And so the basic approach Engel and our colleagues took was sort of twofold. One was to look at what content was constructed in the common ground of the learning interactions amongst the students and between the students and the teachers. And the second was, how did individuals participate in that content that was constructed? So I'm flipping over to slide 9. In one analysis, Engel and Conant hypothesized that the conditions for the students' productive, what they call productive disciplinary engagement, included their being positioned with authority and accountability in a practice. These two concepts are pretty core to their analysis, that this encouraged problematizing the really substantive issues that the children are trying to get a grasp on in the discipline, and that provided resources for them to sort of support the students taking and challenging and supporting their positions on the substantive issues, that is, supporting different aspects of disciplinary argument. And so there's a focus here on authority and accountability in their practice. In Engel 2006, one way they focus on the supporting this kind of accountability and authority is the concept of framing. So from this analysis, it's teacher moves, instructional moves, to support different types of interaction. And so one type of support that Randy and her colleagues focused on was what she called expansive framing. So moves by the teacher to expand the frame and connect the interactions across different dimensions of time, place, and people. So for example, current episodes building on past and current episodes is relevant to future episodes, and so forth. And also looking at how different types of framing can support various types of participation. So how can framing the teacher, framing the students as authors in this set of activities that they were involved in. How does that, the framing of them as authors, support other things like authority, for example? So those are some of the conclusions they took to this analysis and approach. And I'd like to use this brief illustration or example to talk about some definitions and concepts that we think are core to the situative perspective. And so now I'm on slide 10. The first concept is this concept of an activity system that we define as a higher level learning system. And importantly, the unit of analysis is larger, as we've been discussing. Goes beyond the individual person. It's at least two people, two or more people, or an individual working with some other object or technological system, like a computer tutor, for example. This incorporates a range of perspectives that theorize activity systems, including cultural, historical activity theory, situated learning, situated action, distributed cognition, and cultural psychology. Referring back to the Engel and colleagues' work, the activity system there could be sort of thought about in a few ways. It's but most importantly is the group interaction, the small group interaction amongst the students, amongst themselves, and the teacher. But it could also be thought as the tasks that they or incorporated into the tasks that they were working on, the resources that they had, the books and so forth that they were utilizing in their construction of argumentation. So that's the activity system. Next, the community of practice. So this is people who know how to participate in regularly occurring practices of an activity system. And one thing we like to think about in this space is trajectories of participation. And this is what Wenger has called identity. So that particular individuals in a community of practice have trajectories that they go through during the community over time. And referring back to the Randy and colleagues' example, the community of practice, the concepts that sort of support outside of the activity system of the small groups could be thought of as authority and accountability, that these two aspects are sort of macro level. They go outside of those groups and actually across, there are two classrooms and several other analyses in these constructs for how the students acted and interacted in regards to authority and accountability sort of belong to the larger larger context or a larger community beyond the activity system. So that's one thing that's general across the classrooms, and that students would sit down to have discussions that were sort of driven by these practices. The third concept there is the concept of framing, and we refer to Goffman here, and what is can be answered by the framing is what is going on here.
Or I think the way Goffman actually wrote it was, what is it that's going on
here? What is it that's going on here? Yeah, could have a it there. And so it's sort of, what is the higher level structure of the interaction? And from the Engel example, framing, as I had mentioned before, was something that the teacher was interacting with the students to try to construct certain kinds of frames, like expansive frames or bounded frames. On to affordances. So affordances we define as qualities of systems that can support interactions and their present possible interactions for an individual to participate in. And so for the Engel example, some affordances of the interactions between the students could be thought of as accountability and authority, that if those two features of the system are present, they afford the ability that it's okay to express opinions. So if you have these two features, then it's okay to sort of express one's opinion. Should we take questions now?
Are we getting them on the chat? Yeah. There's Dan. What is it that's going on here? Lex, yes. Oh, I can say a little bit about that. In an interaction with a student that Engel called expansive, one aspect of it was authorship. So the teacher would say something like, that's an important idea that you have or that you found. But they also, in expansive framing, also would connect a particular interaction or the content of a particular interaction with something general rather than something bounded. So the importance of a student's idea would be referred to the class as a whole, for example. The other groups will need to know about this too. And in a more bounded version, this is something that you can put in your report.
I see.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's expansive in its significance, and it attributes agency to the student.
Yeah. Okay. So on to slide 11, with a few more concepts and definitions. Constraints, these are thought of as if-then regularities of interactions with material and informational systems that enable a person to anticipate outcomes and participate in trajectories of interaction. And sort of building from Barwais and Perry, from the Engel example, constraints in the interaction could be that if this feature of accountability is present, then if you are accountable, you can't just give any opinions. That is that if this practice is present, it's going to constrain what opinions you give, and probably those that have some basis in evidence, so some type of resource that is meant to back up one's opinion. Information structures, these are, think of, I guess, as patterns of information, or from classical cognitive view, mental representations. I think Jim gave an example earlier on about a problem space, and thinking about a problem place. Space is a classical description of a kind of mental representation in problem solving. You can think about the mental representation also as whether this is conceptual or procedural in nature. So what is the content of what one of the students is thinking about in regards to their own individual cognition in terms of whales? Or orcas, whether or not to classify as a particular category. Participation structures are patterns of interaction in which several of the components of the system coordinate their behaviors as they participate in joint activity. You can think about these interactions as a particular unfolding of the co-construction of who's talking when, if it's a dialogue, and that if there are differences in competence or authority and or autonomy that are sort of driving the particular exchanges that are happening and turn-taking, that sort of unfold. Okay, going on to part two of a framework, so bringing these different concepts together in relation, we've been relating them back to the same general example, and there are just a few more interrelations that we want to introduce here in building on Engstrom's prior work. Talk about this sort of relationship between the subject or agent, which can be the individual or the group. In Engel's case, it's a small group of students and the teacher. The object, so what the subject or the small group in this case was working on. So the argument of deciding whether or not orcas are dolphins or whales could be one aspect of the object of what they're trying to understand in the big old argument example. And the instrument or resources, this is the subject uses, what the subject uses in an effort to transform the object according to the goal. So so to find an answer to that question of what are killer whales, they are a group of individuals, students, are trying to use text, evidence, and various types of reasoning, to disciplinary reasoning, to come to that conclusion. In addition, we wanted to mention that sort of the activity system is smaller than the community, so it sort of can exist within the community, but can have members of the community sort of doing work in the activity system is a subset of the community of practice. And the community itself has a number of activity systems in which the members of that community engage in practice. And so you could have a division of labor, so certain individuals working on certain subtopics or subprojects within that community, and you can also have norms and rules for how that community functions. And so we may come back to probably not all, but definitely some of these concepts as we look at some examples of different types of analysis. But first, we'd like to move on to our first discussion activity. And so this is slide 13, and this is to sort of provide some concrete particulars on your end for thinking about these concepts. So how do or could these concepts get applied in your research? For some of you who have thought a lot about this, you probably have these well aligned and mapped. But for those who are just beginning to think about these things, it's maybe more challenging. And so if you could take 5 minutes to start to have a discussion about how these concepts apply to your own work and recording questions that come up in that application. And we will then have a discussion of things that come up in either in terms of the application or general questions that you have at that point.
Okay, thanks. And so this is an invitation to everyone. What is not fully clear to me now is, Tim and Jim, do you mean 5 minutes to prepare the questions that might be helpful for the groups that are participating so that they can locally discuss? Or should we just brainstorm now with applying these concepts to our own individual work?
Go ahead, Jim. Yeah, so I think 5 minutes to prepare questions to bring back to the larger group. And of course, we won't be able to sample everybody's questions, but 5 minutes to sort of discuss locally or apply locally, and then 5 or 10 minutes to discuss a few of those questions more broadly. Does that sound?
If that's okay, Frank, with the timing that we have.
I think we are still pretty much in the time frame, so we have still like 40 minutes to go. Not sure if we managed to go through all of the activities, but I think we have enough time for the first activity and the next part. So then that would mean 5 minutes for the groups to discuss, for the individuals to reflect, to think about their own research, and then in 5 minutes we are back here. Okay, I think the couple of minutes is over now, so if you can just raise your hand, so just join the queue and come up with questions or ideas how to use these concepts and ideas in your own research.
Hi. I'd like to know if there are any motivational theories that are especially promising for understanding participation in activity systems. Currently, the moment I'm considering self-determination theory, you know, by Ryan and Desi as a good candidate, but I'm sure there are others. So I'd like to know more about you know, where you are with that. Thank you.
So just a quick response to that, and I'll actually open it up for other people who are connected if they have thoughts about this, who are working on motivation. It sort of depends on what aspects of motivation yet you're interested in, and that there are sort of many different theories that I think could be interestingly analyzed from the activity system view. I guess from my own interest in looking into this, that there had been some work by Carol Ames thinking about achievement goals as they are applied in classroom context. That is, what are the features and kinds of at the classroom level activities that support various types of mastery of goals for students to adopt or to work towards in a class versus performance goals. So that's one relation there. But other interesting concepts like beliefs of intelligence by Carol Dweck and other aspects of interest. I don't know of applications at the activity level. Okay. And I don't know if Jim.
Well, there is a, Dan Hickey just added a comment that there's an article on sociocultural theories of motivation that Dan refers us to. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
One issue that gets opened up in this way of thinking about cognition and learning involves the extent or the way in which interaction, people in interaction co-construct motivational states and engagement. So one of the things that's interesting to me anyway about Randy Engel's findings was the way in which a teacher who is providing an expansive environment interacts with students to construct the invitation to frame what the student is doing as something in which the student has agency and has general significance. That's an achievement of the conversational interaction rather than a stable trait of the student. But clearly what the student brings to the situation is important too. And we're in an early stage of figuring out how the complexity of that interaction produces the kind of engagement that leads to productive learning. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, any other comments, results of your reflection and discussions locally?
Just a refresher, I'm looking at, say, third grade students in a group of three who are in an elementary classroom looking at solving an engineering design challenge. And so I'm thinking, based on this theory, that the students would be the subject. And they're using tools, and those would be the resources, but the object itself would be their design, more abstractly, not necessarily the thing that they are constructing. Is that a good way to think about it? Because they would have a goal, which is to, you know, solve the engineering design challenge within the constraints of that challenge. And I'm thinking the object would be their abstract design. Does that make sense?
Sure. One of the things that makes this topic and the work we do challenging and interesting is that the goal of classroom activity often gets framed as finding a good answer to a question or finding the right answer to a math problem. And everybody agrees, though, that at the same time, the goal is, or the object of the activity is the student's knowledge and understanding. So the activity in the classroom is always organized to, we would like to have the goal of the activity of the classroom organized to optimize the chances of students to learn the material, whether it's procedural or conceptual, in which is the subject matter. Okay.
So we probably have time for one more question now, okay. And then probably move on to the next section.
Okay, I jumped in. Cool. I guess going back to my earlier question, and thank you for addressing it, is thinking about how, you know, as learning scientists, to really quantify or at least describe some of these concepts when trying to apply it to my own research or anybody's research question. So, for example, like I am particularly interested in this idea of framing as something that can help facilitate transfer. But I want to know kind of how would I know that the student is in the expansively bound mindset, which would lead me to expect that, okay, now I should be more likely to see transfer and maybe think about what mechanisms are at work or anything like that. But I guess I'm just kind of asking the, I guess, a measurement question of what's the best unit. I guess you started talking a little bit about this idea of unit of analysis, but just I'd like to hear more about that. Thank you.
Want to talk about Tim's been thinking about this.
Well, I think this is a really good question. So thinking about my view of Randy's work and thinking about framing, one place that you can look for the kinds of features that support whether the frame exists. I know you're sort of asking the question about the student's perception or mindset, but I think one way to think about framing is it's itself existing in the interaction. Mm-hmm. So that is the things, the features that you can look for behaviorally are what is the teacher saying? That is, what are their comments that are connecting, you know, taking up the student's comments and connecting them to other comments, and then and also what is the student replying? So I think you could in this case with the expansive framing both look at features of the dialogue, so that is features of what the teacher is describing in the instructional moves, they're making, but also sort of whether or not the student is replying or responding in ways that indicate a sort of alignment with that framing or not that framing. So whether they're picking up certain dialogue moves and running with them or coming back to a previous way of thinking. Those would be some of the features that I would say to look for. And so clearly, those you would need to have some kind of dialogue or capturing the interaction itself in terms of measurement, which is time intensive. But I think this is a really important question about sort of how do we assess and how do we measure these things.
Yeah, I'd say we're probably on the threshold of being able to sort some of this out.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that framing, like other aspects of the content of interaction, is something that is co-constructed by the people who are doing the who are participating in the interaction. So we might take a transcript of this interaction and draw some conclusions about what kind of framing we managed to construct with you, Dan, and with others whose questions we're responding to.
Mm-hmm. So I think we should move on to the next part three, talking about explanation patterns, and then if time, we'll have another activity after going through some discussion of different types of explanation patterns, which I think will actually come back to some addressing a couple of the questions that folks have.
Good. All right. So do we move back to the slides, right?
Yeah, so now we're back in slide mode 15.
Okay. It's 15, and the general point about these comments is to take convey the view that we see an individual cognitive analysis, which is what has come out of cognitive science mainly, and an analysis of activity systems that are successful in achieving cognition as two levels, both of which have value. From Tim and me, you're not getting an argument that the situative approach should replace what we've got. It should be added to it. The point on the slide says studies focused on either level that advance understanding of cognition or learning are valuable contributions. That's a position people talk about pluralism of theories. In particular, a colleague of ours here at the University of Pittsburgh, Sandra Mitchell, has written a book about it, which she called Integrative Pluralism. So we want to assert the potential value of studies at either the individual cognition or the activity system level. If we learn something theoretically significant or practically important, there's much to be gained. But we also maintain the hope that we can make the findings of those two levels coherent. And on slide 16, we begin a discussion of kinds of contributions that can be integrative. And One of them is to explain a phenomenon in a way that includes aspects of interaction, some at the level of individual cognition, and other aspects at the level of cognition by an activity system. And Engels, particularly the paper about transfer, serves to explain, to illustrate that. The framing that Randy is has identified, we would say, includes epistemological framing. A couple of you are at Tufts and probably interact with David Hammer there, for whom epistemological framing has been a productive idea. But another aspect of the framing is, how is the student's participation framed? Does the student get credit for being the originator or the author of some information or an idea? And there are a couple of other examples there. Carla Van de Sand and I published a paper in, I'm pretty sure it was 2011, in the Learning Science Journal. And there's a chapter in a book edited by Keith Stenning and some others. But that's integrative strategy type one, which is look at both levels for factors that can contribute to the explanation that you offer for whatever the phenomenon is that you're trying to that you're focused on. Then on to the next slide. Another way to integrate the levels is to have hypotheses at one level that contribute to the explanation of a phenomenon at the other level. So you can have hypotheses about individual cognition that help explain something at the level of a system. You can have something at the level, a hypothesis at the level of a system that should be in the line there that says system level hypothesis. The parenthesis should be SLH. That helps explain something at the individual level, so that in the parentheses there it should be ILP.
Yeah, I changed that in the final.
Oh, good. And then we have examples of that. The variation in what members of an activity system know can be a useful factor in constructing a phenomenon at the level of the system. A paper 15, 16 years ago now that Ed Hutchins wrote with Clausen used that, or contributed that strategy or that form of explanation, and serves as an early example of distributed cognition. And then the going in the other direction, where you have hypotheses about the system that help you explain individual level learning or cognition, there's a lot of that around, and the study focuses on a program of instruction, and then assesses the results of one program, usually in relation to something that doesn't have the feature, but it assesses individual learning after studying after studying something that has been designed to have a good effect on the learning by students, and then it takes place in a classroom. One comment on sort of the state that we're in now, in most of these studies, the processes in the classroom or classrooms are usually pretty well underspecified or understudied. Something about the activity, take Moss and Case, for example, that was about learning fractions, and there's a good description of activities that the students engaged in, looking at fractions of distances and what fraction is of a cylinder is filled up with something. So the general idea of what the activity involved is spelled out, but there's not an analysis of the kind that we're able to do now, studying patterns of interaction that would contribute to the explanatory success of hypotheses about why those activities rather than something else contributed to the success of the instructional program. We could use more detailed interactional analysis of that. Okay, and then on to another activity, but Frank, you should tell us whether we should wrap up now. It's gotten to be close to 2:30.
Well, my suggestion would be to go through the next activity, and I think those who have to leave but I would really like to work through the next activity still, and I think most of the participants will agree.
Okay, well, the next activity is a question, actually a couple of questions. On slide 19, I'm looking at pages. If learning environments are understood as activity systems in Urjo Engström's style, think about a traditional classroom with a teacher and a group of students. This is probably pretty routine for you. What are the main system components of a classroom, and how's that different if the learning activity is interacting with a computer program? And then, given that classroom learning occurs in an activity system, does it seem okay for researchers or for the practice of instruction to test its effects with individual assessments? And what assumptions can we infer is or are being made for this to be coherent? Take it away.
Mm-hmm. So we don't have any experience on how long to wait for answers in that mode of interaction, but maybe I think you should just join the queue, just also raise other questions if you like, or try to answer or speak to the question that Tim and Jim put. Then Hike, I mean, you also, of course, we would also appreciate hearing you directly, hearing your voice, if you want to speak up.
I suppose for question 2A, I answer by way of example. I mean, I think my dissertation is going to be the assessment, that individual assessment of, you know, obviously a very broad-based activity system engagement, including, you know, webinars like this with my professors, with texts, with colleagues in the field, and essentially that's sort of going to be a culmination of all those things. So I think those, you know, the results of activities can certainly be written into an individual product.
Okay. First of all, there's a comment by Dan Hickey that says the way we resolve this is to recognize that the a classroom presents a special case of socially situated activity. That seems right to me. Its peculiarities are things that probably ought to be a subject of our study with technology and with the assessments are particularly peculiar, says Dan. True enough, and they illustrate this level shift because in bad old-fashioned pedagogy, it was assumed that it was just a group of individuals responding to the information given by a teacher. But as we develop this notion of activity systems engaged in cognition and co-constructing frames and all that, we're creating an interesting theoretical question, which is how do these activities in which people collaborate and interact and co-construct things, how does that have an effect on the individual students? Mm-hmm. And what do we need to understand about their participation in order to fully grasp what it is that's important to be sure we do when we have classrooms full of students? Does that help?
I guess the only thing I would add, I don't know if it directly relates to that question, but maybe both the question and the comments before, is that I think it would be interesting to, in addition to these individual assessments, which may have these peculiar features that we're discussing, have imagine what it would look like to sort of do, since we're interested in this as a research question on two levels, look at assessment at two levels and
sure.
Look at the activity systems and develop assessments. And I'm sure there are some variations of that in, you know, some engineering education context, the group project sort of perspective that the group works on a project together, they get evaluated on a project together. Might be one approach to that, but I think it's peculiar that we have such a focus on the individual
yeah.
level without trying to think through the activity level as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Greeno and Grisalfi is another handbook chapter. It was a project that went on for a while, and it was organized by Ed Hartle and a couple of people.
I would like to ask you whether you perceive activity systems as self-emergent system and self-formed systems, or as systems with prescriptive values that have that underline instructional approaches. Thank you.
Sorry, I was distracted.
So the emergent properties of activity systems and whether they have prescriptive features. Do you have an example for the kinds of activity systems that you're thinking about?
I had in mind the notion of legitimate peripheral participation, which, according to Lev and Wenger, they have no prescriptive value and they cannot be used as pedagogical strategies. So I was wondering, what is the relationship between emergence and design in the activity systems as well?
Well, I think that the way in which activity systems like the ones that Lev and Wenger passed on to us, those were all based on research that had been more fully reported elsewhere than in their little book. I think we could approach the prescription, the question of prescription, by looking at the success of activity systems in accomplishing their intended purposes. So if the purpose of the activity system is to make clothes, like the tailoring establishments that Lev studied, then they're good at they're valuable if they do a good job at that, so I guess to get clear about being prescriptive or not, we need to be sure that we understand the intentions, the goals, the purposes of the system that we're studying, and it may be successful from one perspective on what they're doing, and not so successful on something else.
Yeah, I guess I'd say that I'm particularly interested in this issue as sort of a newcomer to this iterative perspective of what aspects of an activity system are emergent. Clearly some will be emergent, and what things can be more structurally replicated across new contexts and new situations. Yeah. From a transfer perspective, I'm very interested in what features, structural aspects of activity systems that lead to affordances and constraints that in certain types of practices can be found across different activity systems in different contexts and clearly across different contexts or new situations, new features will emerge. And so I think for me, that at least is partially a research question of whether there are prescriptive, whether there are co-occurring features across activity systems, if we can conceptualize that and create ways to analyze and promote those in new activity system settings.
So one way to address the issue of prescription is to ask about alternative purposes for the activity. I think we're in the middle of a debate now that reaches the question of what are the most important functions or purposes of instruction. So Jennifer has just put in the discussion that the whale discussion was emergent, not prescriptive. There were some pretty prescriptive things that the teacher did when she gathered the group together to start the big old argument. One of the things was the students were going to have to make a decision about whether to include orcas in their whale report or not. That was prescribed, but the answer was not prescribed. The prescription was you're going to have to work this out. Discussed this example with some audiences, somebody in the audience sometimes raises the question, look, they spent all that time arguing about something. Why didn't the teacher just look it up and tell them? that would have served a different purpose. Oh, okay. Glad you were here, Tufts. but the prescription is going to come partly from within the group, and what are the practices that the group complies with, and partly from the perspective of somebody who's evaluating what they did. Okay.
Okay, I think we should move on. Maybe Tim and Jim, not sure if you want to speak to the some future directions. I think that would be a very good also closing slide for that webinar. I think it would have been very interesting also to discuss your question 2A with the individual assessment, of course, in the classroom. My suggestion would be to move on and come to the future direction for situative research and situative or research on situative cognition.
Okay, slide 20, we have just a few thoughts on future directions, which I think relate to several of the questions and interests that folks have brought up during our discussions. One is to further integrate, as I think we were trying to do in thinking about this last set of discussion questions, activity system explanations with individual cognitive explanations and develop frameworks and more research targeting both levels. Thinking about coherence across the levels to build broader theory.
Sure.
The second one I have on here came up a few times, analyzing classroom level motivation, or you could just think about it more, we could generalize that to broader motivation outside of the individual, whether that's in classroom or informal contexts, how do other individuals help structure that motivation, contribute to that motivation, as well as the environment or technology systems. And I think this, for me, is a new direction to think about. And coordinating that those aspects with both the activity level and the individual level, as well as with the cognitive unfolding at the individual and the activity system level. Clearly, they're coordinated and integrated in various learning activities. And I think it's a really important aspect, and it has, I think, from my view, a large potential to contribute to our understanding of learning, particularly at the activity level, and thinking about how motivation lives at that level and maybe drives a lot of the other aspects of cognitive processing at both levels. Mm-hmm. And the final point I have on there is getting back to our also one of our discussion questions about developing assessments for both the cognitive and motivational aspects of the activity systems. And I think there's a lot of future work along these directions that can be developed.
Yeah, right. One of the things that's in that third category in Engel's 2006 paper, we gave group assessments as well as individual interviews, and they turned out pretty much the same. That is the shift in discourse that occurred in the group activity when we gave them a transfer problem. Also showed up when we asked when we had individual interviews and were asking them assessment questions. So that's a good outcome. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to face up to a discrepancy between what happened when the students were working in groups. But our assessment of the group activity was pretty much at the level of standard discourse analysis. We looked for aspects of the content and as well as participation by the students. Did the groups get better? Yes, in some ways. Did the individuals express better understanding in their interviews? Yes. And they turned out to involve some of the same features of understanding. So that's a small example of one of the ways in which some of that assessment can be going on in both levels. You arrange to get information about groups and about individuals.
Yeah. So you have so I don't know if we should take some.
Hi. I have a question with regard to these last comments about what's the future questions for research. I was thinking that it might be interesting to think about this question of assessment as if the classroom, learning in the classroom is about affordances and constraints that happen in the classroom, how can we assume that those affordances and constraints are also present in the text, in the examination later on? And I guess that shift between the situated action and the affordances and constraints that you find there in the interaction with someone else, and those that you find yourself alone, could be also a question.
You've identified one of the problems we need to take very seriously. But we don't know enough to prescribe an answer to it yet. But with good with successful research on this, we might well. The uses of assessments now are expanding, and the assessments that we know how to design pretty much focus on individual levels of knowledge and cognition and reasoning. Mm-hmm. If somebody is very good at contributing to groups and to teams effectively, we usually just find out about that in letters of recommendation. it would be an important breakthrough if you or somebody was able to get us a real clarifying set of results about the constraints of the effect of constraints of individual performance in relation to some of the things that involve participation that we also care about.
Okay. In the final phase of the webinars, I always ask the presenters two questions, and the first question that I normally present caused some laughing on the side of some colleagues when I told them I will ask Jim Greenough and Tim Noakes about how situative cognition is related to the learning sciences. I think I will skip this question. I think that became very, very clear that this is foundational to the learning sciences for the whole field, and has been like that. Let me go to the second question, and Jennifer already started with this type of question. I think her question is very relevant. So this article that everyone read as a preparation for this webinar, could you tell us how this has been written, or how you wrote this paper together with Engström? And my second question is, what would be your recommendations, Tim and Jim, for PhD students who want to integrate concepts of situative cognition into their own work? I think what we learned today is that many of the participants did not yet really consider deeply these concepts in their work, but what would be your recommendation to be included? I think one important step, of course, would be to include different levels of analysis, but maybe you have some more recommendations for these PhD students.
I like that recommendation. I can tell you about Greenough and Engström. The Cambridge Handbook of the Learning Sciences they're assembling a second division. I wrote a chapter in the first edition. Keith Sawyer is the editor of that. Keith asked me to revise that chapter for the second edition. And he also said he would like to have some authors who weren't from the U.S. Yrjö Engström's very significant role in the development of activity theory, it seemed quite natural to ask him to join in the writing of a chapter about learning. So we did, and he agreed, and the chapter that is on the website now is the result of that. About recommendations?
I guess in addition to thinking about two levels of analysis, I guess it's been very helpful for me to engage with people, other folks doing this research like Jim and begin conversations. And so I would, I guess I would encourage new folks to thinking about these kinds of concepts. I mean, one step is a webinar to bring us together and connect us, but I think going beyond that and at conferences, for example, the Learning Sciences, having a community that you talk with other researchers about the application of these concepts and how they're brought together in various contexts, whether it's a Learning Science Conference or AERA or early, bringing people together to share ideas has been extremely helpful for me in thinking about the application of a lot of these concepts to research, because I think for me at least, thinking about these concepts both can help structure the kinds of work that you go out and do, but it also can be a lens that you apply to already collected data or past work that you have done, and both can be very informative approaches to engaging in this kind of pursuit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. I think also we have to close this webinar now. We went a little bit over time. It was highly interesting to all of us, to me as well. Well, I was thinking a lot about units of analysis, but it was specifically clear, it became specifically clear to me in this discussion how important it is to analyze learning on different levels of analysis and to try to integrate these. So maybe we have a quick round of bye-byes by everyone, and then we thank again Tim and Jim for taking the time for preparing that and for taking the discussion on situative cognition into the next phase in this webinar. I think that will be also very helpful for many students who will watch this webinar in the future in different courses worldwide. Thanks a lot, Tim and Jim.
Well, we are grateful for the opportunity and for everyone's participation. Thank you all very, very much.
Yes, thank you very much. It was nice to meet all of you.
So thank you also from the LMU in Munich. As you can see, most of us unfortunately already had to leave, but we had quite some discussion here and I for myself learned a lot. So thank you very much, and for all the others I just wanted to mention that you can find the recording of this webinar and the recording of other webinars on the Naples internet page, naples.isls.org. Bye bye, see you.
Bye bye. Yeah, I just wanted to thank you everybody for organizing this seminar, especially to Ian and team. Good night from Norway.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you very much. It was really interesting. The article is fantastic. I'm really impressed to see Greeno and Engstrom on the same page. It's quite a read. Yeah, thank you very much. If you do want to comment more about how you actually wrote the paper, I'd really like to hear it, but I understand we're also short on time. Okay, thanks again.